travelers, and welcome to Go See, Do, Explore.
Here, we dive deep into the heart of travel, sharing hidden gems, unforgettable experiences, and the stories that make each destination unique.
Whether you're a seasoned traveler or dreaming of your next getaway, you're in the right place to get inspired.
I'm Christopher.
And I'm Ashley.
And together, we'll set the course for your next great adventure and discover the stories that make each place unforgettable.
It's time to go, see, and do more. Let's explore.
We're back for the third and final part of our Michigan bucket list. We've covered now the Upper Peninsula, and we've covered the Western Lower Peninsula of Michigan. What we have left is the Eastern Lower Peninsula. And so we'll be talking through 8 different destinations that we think are must-dos here in the Eastern Lower Peninsula, most of which we've done. We'll talk about that, though, too. So our first bucket list destination in the Eastern Lower Peninsula is the Henry Ford. The Henry Ford is composed of the Henry Ford Museum, Greenfield Village, and a few other places of historic interest or educational interest.
So the Henry Ford Museum, it was renamed a few years ago to the Henry Ford Museum of American Innovation.
That's right.
Because I guess there were some people that came to Michigan to visit the museum expecting it to be a museum to Henry Ford, when in fact it is a museum that was started by Henry Ford of just things that were interesting to him. And so there are some very interesting exhibits in the Henry Ford. Probably the biggest and most well-known would be the Lincoln chair. So Henry Ford acquired the chair from Ford's Theater where Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. And apparently, you know, we went on a tour of the museum once and our tour guide told us that initially when this item became available, Ford's secretary was like, why would he be interested in that? It's so morbid. But it has kind of become a hallmark of the museum. And they ended up building an entire exhibit around the Lincoln chair and also Rosa Parks bus, all having to do with civil rights. So it's very interesting. The museum also has Ford's private train, because if you were a very wealthy person in that time, you had your own train. There are airplanes. There's a recreation of the assembly line for the Model T. What are some other exhibits? The Dymaxion House, which is
Buckminster Fuller's weird house that everyone was going to live in.
Yeah, crazy, crazy thing. What are some other exhibits?
There's that Hallmark one.
Oh, yes, the Hallmark ornament exhibit that will make your eyes explode.
They have all those cars and campers and there's all that. And
cars, farm. Kind of cars through the ages, which is always fun to walk through, you know, starting pre-Model T even and going to, I think I want to say the most recent one is from like the 80s.
Yeah, there might be like a 94 Ford Taurus or something like that.
Yeah.
There's the farm implements and there's some glass in there. There's all kinds of stuff. The Wienermobile is there.
I'm surprised you didn't mention the vial of Edison's last breath.
Yes. This is kind of a crazy thing that when Thomas Edison died, people captured these vials of like his quote unquote last breath. There's a bunch of them that exist, but there's one in a case, but in that same case is actually the death mask of Nikola Tesla, and it's facing a DC power generator. And so the famous rivalry between Tesla and Edison over whether AC or DC power would prevail. Obviously, the museum leans a little towards Edison by putting the death mask of Tesla facing a DC generator. So I don't know if it's on purpose or not, but it seems kind of on purpose.
Well, I mean, the museum was originally named the Edison Institute because Henry Ford was a big fan of Thomas Edison. And probably one of my favorite things in the museum is a giant painting of, I believe it's the 100th anniversary of the incandescent light. They had a big event at the museum and this painting commemorates it. And there's even a plaque down below that'll show you who all the people are. That's a cool thing. But anyway, not to talk about the museum forever, because there's also Greenfield Village, which is a wonderful historic village that once again, Ford started as kind of a almost a little utopia, I think, was the initial idea there, where people were going to live in the village and there was a school in the village. And it's not that. But now there are these historic buildings that you can walk through in the summer months. And they are also getting a new house, one of the houses from Alabama that some of the civil rights leaders met at. So that's coming soon. Hopefully, I don't know if it's going to be 2024 or if it'll be later. And the newest exhibit or the newest building is the Detroit City Market at Greenfield Village, where they have set up. The city of Detroit was going to knock it down and just throw all the pieces away, but the Henry Ford saved it and built a smaller version of it in Greenfield Village, and they use it for farmers markets and things like that. And also on the Henry Ford campus, you can do Rouge factory tours, so you can see them building the F-150. So you can go from, you know, the Cotswold Cottage, really, really old, or the Daggett farmhouse from the 1600s in Greenfield Village to modern day technology at the Henry Ford.
I really like going to the village and just walking around. As members, we end up just kind of going there and walking around and not always going in the things because we've been in them before. But one thing I think that's worth mentioning about the museum and then the Henry Ford in general is that I think one of the greatest qualities it has is that celebration and also forward look at American innovation. That's really what the whole place turns on. There's elements of history, too. But I know, you know, there's been a lot in the past number of years about people in our history not always being the greatest people in terms of their personal views and the way they treated others. And what I like about the Henry Ford is that this is not a shrine to Henry Ford or Thomas Edison or any of these other people. It's really a look at the legacy that we have as a country in terms of developing technology and science and things that lead to world progress and to the betterment of mankind. And that's running throughout the whole Henry Ford. It's one of the reasons why I love going there and I'm happy to be a member there. Our second item on the list is something very different from the Henry Ford, Tawas Point Lighthouse. Tawas Point Lighthouse is in Tawas State Park. It's located in Tawas, Michigan, or Tawas, near Tawas City, Michigan, or East Tawas, one of those. They're close together. It's in neither of them. It's near both of them. Cool, iconic lighthouse.
It's on Lake Huron, and obviously that area of Lake Huron was known for a lot of shipwrecks. You know, it's not too far from the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary in Lake Huron, where there's countless shipwrecks. It's not as much as, you know, when we talked about Whitefish Point in the UP, and Lake Huron isn't Lake Superior, but it does have its fair share of shipwrecks. So the lighthouse was built in 1853 to prevent shipwrecks around Tawas Point. The lighthouse is a very iconic structure with the, you know, very typical old house in the front with the tower part in the back, which you can climb. And yeah, it's just a great little part of Great Lakes history on the eastern side of the state.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that there are a fair number of shipwrecks in Lake Huron, and I think it's worth mentioning, especially in that area, from 40 Mile Point down to Presque Isle, that really is, there's a heavy concentration there in the Thunder Bay. Lots of diving activities go on there. There's a museum in Alpena that's dedicated to this sort of thing. So there are actually a lot of lighthouses there, too. Tawas Point is one of the most significant ones, but there are lots. You can make a day of it, as we did a few years ago, and just go to all those lighthouses. Next on the list is a city that's just north of us, Frankenmuth, Michigan. Frankenmuth, you might at first glance think is a tourist trap. And maybe to some degree it is. You go there and it's one of these sort of German-themed villages. If you're familiar with Leavenworth, Washington, or if you're familiar with Solvang, that's not German, but it's the same kind of a thing where it's the whole town is themed, so to speak. And there are touristy things to do there, and there's, well, we'll talk about the food in a minute, but beneath that touristy exterior, Frankenmuth has a history, is actually a city settled by missionaries from Germany. Frankenmuth means courage of the Franconians. The people that settled Frankenmuth came from Franconia, not Bavaria, oddly enough, despite sort of the Bavarian theming of a lot of it. Americans know Bavaria. It's sort of familiar. But there's a real German immigrant history there with real German roots. And it just so happened that a lot of those German immigrants discovered that the best way for them to make money was to set up a little Germany in East Central Michigan and have people come and buy chicken dinners. And so touristy on the surface for sure, but also deeper things to discover there.
Frankenmuth is probably best known for its dueling chicken dinner restaurants. They're right across the street. Coincidentally, not coincidentally, but they're owned by the same family. So Zender's and then the Bavarian Inn are the two restaurants. They serve the exact same meal. And somehow they managed to both stay afloat in this little town.
I feel like you just upset everyone by saying the exact same meal because there are partisans for each one. And yeah.
We tend to be a Zender's family, even though we got married in Frankenmuth and had our reception at the Bavarian Inn. So we spread the wealth. But it's, yeah, like I said, we got married there. Holds a special place in my heart. In both of our hearts, I hope. But it's just, yeah, it can be super cheesy. There's the taffy shops, the fudge shops.
T-shirts.
For some reason, a Scottish store now.
Yeah.
The food is great. It's kind of a yearly tradition that we probably end up at Zender's to get the chicken dinner at least once a year. And probably Chris's favorite restaurant in all of Michigan is...
Yeah, before we talk about that, I just want to say one thing about the chicken dinners. Like, they're all right. I mean, they're pretty good. It's not bad. It's not, you know, I would not say that the food is the star of the show per se, but it's especially when you consider the volume that they crank out, it's actually pretty impressive. We had heard some statistics about like how many pounds of chicken and how many pounds of butter and things like that these restaurants go through in a day, but they have many large dining rooms, both restaurants. And yeah, it's one of those iconic Michigan things. Ashley mentioned my favorite restaurant. I'm pretty sure it is, at least in Michigan. Its name is Prost. They're not sponsoring us, although I would love it if they did. It's a wine bar. They have charcuterie. It's totally up my alley. But they have tap wine. I love any place that has wine on tap. I think it's a really great system, and I wish everyone had it. That would be incredible.
And we should probably also mention what might be the biggest destination in Frankenmuth, and that is Bronner's, is the world's largest Christmas store. We were just there last weekend, and it's a little overwhelming. I cannot imagine. We were kind of talking about what do people who, you know, are coming there for the first time think of this place.
Yeah, obviously we've acclimated because we've gone there from childhood, but yeah, it would be pretty crazy. If anyone's going there for the first time, let us know because it's pretty insane.
Walls and walls and walls of ornaments.
Yeah, it becomes really busy, as you could imagine, in the couple months leading up to Christmas. We tend to buy gifts for people from there for like when they have kids or weddings, things like that. And so if we can, we try to time it in an off season so that we're the only people in the place, which is what it's like most of the year.
Yes. Yes. If Frankenmuth in general does get very busy in the summer and then also probably Halloween to Christmas, if you can visit January, February, when they don't have a festival going on. We should probably mention the festival. So, you know, we love Snowfest, which is their big winter festival where they carve, instead of ice, they carve giant snow sculptures. But probably the biggest one is their Oktoberfest, which at least a few years ago, they were saying is the only Oktoberfest that's like sanctioned by Bavaria or the German government outside of Germany.
Yeah.
So
it's in September, as all Oktoberfests are.
But yeah, if you manage to avoid those big festival weekends and you're outside of the summer and Halloween to Christmas, there shouldn't be many crowds at all.
Mm-hmm. The city spends a lot of time, energy, and money on beautification, too. Like, there are flowers everywhere in the summer. It's a tourist-focused city, for sure. But it's really fun. It's really fun. And you can have the experience you want to have there. If you want to go to the hotel that is a water park, you can do that. But if you want to spend time walking alongside the river and seeing the flowers and going to the wine bar, you can have that trip, too. And that's the one we usually do.
And we should probably mention we really love the Marv Herzog Hotel, which is a Drury Hotel. It is not far at all from Prost. It's just pretty much across the street.
Yeah, across the street.
Works out. They offer beer and wine and appetizers. Kind of, I think it's like 4 to 7, and then free breakfast in the morning. So it's a nice little treat if you're kind of trying to stay away from the kid-centered, the big water park hotels that are in town. We really enjoy the Herzog, and they've got rooms that face Main Street, or you can have rooms that face the river with little balconies. We've never stayed there at a time when it's comfortable to use the balcony, but in theory, you could.
In theory, you could. Okay, the next place on our list is Belle Isle. Belle Isle is an island in the Detroit River. It is inside of the city of Detroit. It is to Detroit what places like Central Park are to New York, or what Boston Common is to Boston. It is sort of the big recreational park of the city. One of the things that's significant about Belle Isle as a city park is that it was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, who famously designed Central Park and many, many other important urban parks. It has that same pedigree as a lot of the other great city parks. And it had a heyday in the city of Detroit, and then as Detroit had a lot of struggles in the 20th century, it, especially financial troubles, it fell into extreme disrepair. During some of Detroit's emergency management and bankruptcy a couple decades ago, the city of Detroit ended up leasing the park to the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, who has been managing it as a state park. And so there was a large infusion of cash, lots of cleanup and staffing and services, and it's in great shape now. We really love to go to Belle Isle. And if you're familiar with Belle Isle and you haven't been there since all that happened, I know it's been a while now, but I think that some people still haven't been there, you need to go because it's in great shape now. It's a beautiful spot in the middle of the river. You see Detroit on one side, you see Windsor, Ontario, Canada on the other side. Lots to do. Yeah, what do you like to do most on Belle Isle?
It's always fun to take the walk to the lighthouse because it's a very unique kind of Art Deco style lighthouse.
Is it the only marble lighthouse in the United States? Is that right?
I don't know that.
It's a marble lighthouse. Like, it's made out of marble. Like, you know, the stone. Like, it's not really very common.
No. There's the conservatory, which is beautiful and maintained by the Belle Isle Conservatory Association or something like that.
I think it's the Belle Isle Conservancy.
There it is. So even when kind of the rest of the park was kind of falling into disrepair, the conservatory was still being maintained and is still, you know, as beautiful as ever. And I really love the tiny little aquarium, which before its closure, you know, in the height of the disrepair of Belle Isle, I guess you could say, it was the oldest continually operating aquarium in the United States. So it is open again, and it has beautiful tile work on the walls and the ceiling. And it's, if you haven't seen it, you have to go because it's hard to describe. Now I don't think for most people, you're not going to go there for the experience of seeing the fish. I believe they're all native Michigan Great Lakes fish. So it's not, you're not going to go find Nemo there.
I mean, maybe. He wasn't supposed to be in Australia in that dentist office either. Well, I suppose it's possible.
But if you want to see the local fish of the Great Lakes and Michigan's inland rivers, you can see them there.
It is worth mentioning the koi that they have on Belle Isle. For many years, they had to be transferred by bucket, essentially, between their outdoor habitat and their indoor habitat because it's too cold outside for them in the winter. And so there was a big koi festival every year, and people would come and basically scoop up these koi in their buckets and move them from their one habitat to the other. And there would be various, I think, Japanese cultural activities that correspond with what a koi festival is like in Japan. To my knowledge, they still do the koi festival, but the buckets are no longer necessary. A few years ago, they got some funding, and they were able to build an indoor-outdoor habitat that didn't require people to scoop the fish. They have one habitat now, but there still is a koi festival.
There's a little zoo on Belle Isle. And then, of course, you know, we mentioned the original purpose of Belle Isle was a recreational area for the people of Detroit. So there are beaches where you can swim in the Detroit River, which I can imagine like 10, 15 years ago, you would not want to be swimming in the Detroit River.
It's a lot cleaner now.
Yeah.
People are swimming there all the time in the summer.
And I really like the Scott Fountain. It's a very beautiful piece of sculpture in Belle Isle.
Yeah, really nice views of the Detroit skyline, and especially at sunset. It's all kind of lined up perfectly. There's a sun, I think it's Sunset Point, right, is what it's called, where you've got the Detroit city skyline, you've got the Ambassador Bridge to Canada, the Detroit River. It's a very scenic place.
Just be prepared if you're on Belle Isle for your phone to welcome you to Canada.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those who don't live near an international border don't know what that's like to get those texts, even when they're still.
Just make sure you have international roaming off and you should be fine.
Yeah, you should be fine. Okay, well, we're about halfway through our list and it is time for our wine break. Since this is our last Michigan bucket list episode, we thought it was only right to have another Michigan wine. Thankfully, we have plenty of that. So what we're drinking right now is a Merlot from a winery called Hickory Creek. Hickory Creek is in Buchanan, Michigan, at least technically. It's kind of in between a bunch of places, but it's in the Lake Michigan Shore AVA. Lake Michigan Shore is in the very southwest of Lower Michigan. It's on Lake Michigan, as the name suggests, but it's not that close to a lot of the other wine production. And the wine production we've talked about so far from Michigan has been in Leelanau and Old Mission AVAs, which are sort of in the northwest corner of Lower Michigan in the Traverse City area. This is closer to Chicago. It's in Michigan, but it's sort of in striking distance of Chicago. And so this is a pretty popular area for tourists from Chicago to come up to Michigan and enjoy our dunes and our beaches and our wine. Hickory Creek is a really small production winery, but it's one of my favorites. We've had the opportunity to meet the winemaker and owner there a few times. He's always been really friendly and helpful and always really interesting to talk to about his winemaking. He does have some production of grapes. I don't think he has a lot. He buys, obviously, fruit from local farmers, too. But one of the things I really like about Hickory Creek is it seems like he very often pushes his winemaking in really interesting directions. Time and time again, Hickory Creek produces wine that I find very interesting and different from a lot of other wine that you find even in Michigan. And so it's one of my favorites. I always love going there too. They have cool property with like this big red barn and nice outdoor seating when the weather cooperates. So this Merlot is from 2020. And, you know, 2020 is another one of those years for wine that whenever it comes up, you always think about what was going on when people were growing those grapes and harvesting those grapes, doing all that. But it's held up quite nicely. It's really good. Great Michigan wine. Our next stop on the Michigan bucket list is the Detroit Institute of Arts. Obviously in Detroit, Michigan. The Detroit Institute of Arts, or the DIA as most people call it, is a really fantastic art museum in our region with all sorts of great and interesting pieces.
I believe it was actually just named the best art museum in America by the USA Today 10 Best poll.
Wow, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, just like a few weeks ago.
Okay.
One of the things the DIA is known for is Rivera Court.
Yeah. The Detroit Industry Murals is the name of the piece in Rivera Court. So Diego Rivera, a famous artist, muralist, he was asked or commissioned, I suppose, to paint these gigantic murals at the DIA. And so what he painted was murals of Detroit industry. And Detroit at that time, as well as today, is a big hub for automotive manufacturing, but also aviation and some other things, too. And so he painted factories and things of that nature, but there's also a lot of really interesting symbolism and little nods that he put in the work. Like, for example, the executive supervising the factory line has the face of Edsel Ford and things like that. It's a place you can stand and look for a long time because it's kind of all around you. It's also in this really beautiful court with all this marble and glass, but it's a place you can spend a lot of time just looking around.
I really enjoy the architecture of the DIA. Probably, it's like if you were to ask me what my favorite piece of art is, I don't know that I could name one.
It's not the celery vase. That's one of my favorites.
But I love just looking around at the beautiful old Detroit building that is the DIA. And it's a very intricate, very beautiful.
Yeah, it's an amazing building. There are also some fairly significant works of art there. Works by Monet, Picasso, Van Gogh, Cézanne, a lot more. Some you would see in other museums too, because they're not the only version or not the only one that that artist did. But there are others that I think are really special. Some old Dutch works and things like that, things on wood. And I have my favorites for sure. I'm not going to name them all here now, but works of art that I could go stare at for a long time.
And kind of like you mentioned with Belle Isle, of course, the DIA was in a lot of trouble 20 years ago with the bankruptcy hearings in Detroit. Some of the works of art that were owned by the museum were like on the chopping block, about to be auctioned off to, you know, pay the city's debts.
Right. Yeah, there were works of art owned by the city. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, the DIA was able to navigate that whole situation without losing a single work of art, which is pretty incredible. Thanks to donors and organizations. And we were able to keep our art here.
And the counties, right?
I guess the last thing worth mentioning about the DIA is they can sometimes have really, really great exhibits. We were members for a while because it seemed like there was just exhibit after exhibit that we wanted to go see. And so we actually joined as members, and we may do that again someday. But we always keep an eye out for interesting things coming to that museum. Our next item on the Michigan bucket list is one that actually we haven't been to yet, and that is the Eastern Market. I don't know much about the Eastern Market. What do you know about it?
So Eastern Market is a historic commercial district in the city of Detroit. It is the largest historic market district in the country at 43 acres. And like you would imagine for, you know, a city market, it changes various days of the week. So the Saturday market is probably the biggest, with, you know, everything from your produce that you need for the week to, you know, chefs cooking up tacos or whatever for you to eat. And then on Sunday, it kind of becomes more of like a craft show, craft fair with local artists, musicians, and more. And it's also known in the summer to have a night market with food, drinks, music, and shopping. One of the probably most popular days of the year is Flower Day in the spring. We're making it a goal to visit Eastern Market this year, and I want to go on Flower Day.
Yeah, I hope we can go.
Obviously, we haven't been, so we don't have a ton to say, but that's kind of a little overview of Eastern Market.
The next place on our Michigan bucket list is a geological formation known as Turnip Rock. Turnip Rock is near Port Austin, and you cannot get to it by land unless you live in or have access to a very exclusive neighborhood. It's a private neighborhood. And so the rock, it's this sort of inverted triangle. I think it reminds some people of a turnip, probably. I'm assuming that's why it's called. I don't know if that's true. I think that's what it is. But it's only maybe, 100 yards off of the coast in the Lake Huron. It's very close to land. But the land is private. And so it's kind of this interesting situation where you have this really scenic place that people basically can't get to. So how do they get to it? They kayak from Port Austin. It's a couple miles. I don't remember the exact distance. It's a couple miles, though. It takes you, 2 hours or whatever to get out there, maybe depending on how fast you paddle. But you can kayak from Port Austin. You can rent kayaks if you want, or if you have your own kayak, you can certainly do that too. You get out there. You basically have to stay in the kayak. You're technically allowed to step out if you're below the high water line. It's not marked. I mean, it's better just to stay in the kayak typically so that you're not trespassing. But it's a really fun paddling trip to get over there, and it's pretty cool and scenic.
Mm-hmm. You are paddling on Lake Huron, so if you are planning on bringing your own kayak, definitely watch. I believe the local tour company is called Port Austin Kayak, and they will post on their Facebook or, you know, their social media if it is not safe to do the paddle that day. So keep an eye on that. And of course, you know, if you aren't bringing your own boat, rent from them or another company out that way that'll, you know, kind of tell you what to do. But it's you're on Lake Huron, which, if you aren't familiar with the Great Lakes, it's kind of like a small ocean. There are waves, there's current. So it's not an easy paddle and not for the faint of heart. We found that going out there wasn't too bad, but it was getting back was a lot harder.
I think the wind had picked up. And it's just, you know, those sorts of things, things that you don't really worry about when you're on a river or maybe a small inland lake, can really make a big difference. Even though we were just a little bit offshore, we always had the shore in sight. Nevertheless, you know, you're in a kayak. Sometimes you're paddling sort of perpendicular to the wave action, which can be a really tippy sort of thing. And then if the wind starts blowing, it can be challenging for sure. And you have to be able to have the stamina to get the rest of the way there, because there's not really anywhere to bail. I mean, you're pretty much in it when you're out there. So yeah, be careful, but it's really fun.
Yeah, and it's a great sight to see. If you haven't seen the pictures, it looks a lot like if you chopped off a part of Pictured Rocks and put it in the middle of Lake yeah, Huron. Totally. On a smaller scale, obviously. But yeah, we got out there, I think it was a Saturday morning when we finally made it. And, you know, it was pretty early when we left, and I was surprised at how many people were already out there. So I can only imagine on, a Saturday or Sunday afternoon how busy it gets.
Yeah, we got out there quick because our kayak is ripping fast. We'll talk more about our kayak probably some other time.
Yes.
But we can do like 6 miles an hour sometimes, which is fast in a kayak. Moving on. Our last item on the Michigan bucket list, both for Eastern Lower Michigan as well as the total list, is the Motown Museum in Detroit. I'm assuming most of you have heard of Motown as, you know, a very popular record label and then also sort of a label for a style of music that has extended, I believe, beyond the actual label itself. And that label originated in Detroit, Michigan. Motown was founded by Berry Gordy and had many others that you would know involved. People like Smokey Robinson, Aretha Franklin, Marvin Gaye,
Michael Jackson,
The Four Tops. We could go on and on. There's so many. We would be leaving people out. Let's not. But iconic sound. And it all started in Detroit. A lot of the early Motown stars were just like neighbors in Detroit. And Berry Gordy and the people that worked at Motown had worked out this system to take these kids, essentially, that had raw talent, but didn't know how to go on tour, didn't know how to essentially become stars, and put them through this sort of factory process of, here's how you get better at singing, here's how you get better at dancing, here's how you talk to the press, here's like all those things, right? Here's how you dress, here's how you walk, here's how, like everything. I mean, you can kind of be skeptical of some of that, but it really worked in terms of producing these huge household names and taking a style of music that was much more of kind of an enclave and making it a nationwide household style. Motown eventually moved to Los Angeles, but it started here in Detroit, and it's, of course, named after Detroit being the Motor City. I really love the style of music myself, and going there was a really, really incredible experience.
Motown, the record label, was founded in an old house in Detroit, and then they progressively bought all the other houses right around it and across the street. And after they moved to California, people started knocking on the door wanting to see where these famous albums were recorded. So that's kind of how the museum came to be. You know, they left somebody behind in Detroit, and she realized pretty quickly that this is something that people wanted to see. They wanted to, you know, see where they packaged their albums on the dining room table. And if you do the tour, currently the museum is only available by a tour, which we didn't really know until we got there. We ended up in a tour and we got to see everything. But the tour ends in the studio where you get to sing and dance to My Girl. So that you can say you have sung in the Motown studio. It's a really cool experience. I highly recommend it if you're going to be in the Detroit area. I was very surprised on our tour. I think we were the only local people that were there. It was the day of a Lions playoff game, so there were some people from other places that happened to be in town and were looking for something to do. But they are also in the middle of a renovation. They're building a whole new giant museum complex that will not require a tour to see, and I will be able to put more of the artifacts out for the public. I believe I saw that the plans include additional studio space that you can just lease. I think that's a part of the plan.
If you want to record your next album in the Motown studio, I think that's the pitch. I have to say, too, it was a really good tour, not just for the elements of the tour, which were all awesome, but also our tour guide, I thought, did a really great job. And it seemed like it wasn't just because he was a good tour guide. Like, it seems like they've got a good tour set up. Mm-hmm. They give you the right information at the right times, and they show you the right things at the right times. Yeah, there's a lot more we could say about the things you see there, but you should just go. It's really cool.
If you're interested in reading more, After we went, I did just write a whole blog post about it, so you can read it on the blog.
Yeah, sounds good. So that is the end of our Michigan bucket list. And again, you can access that whole list on our blog. We'll post that as well, so you can go read and reference. Love to know what you think, if you've been to these places, if you want to go to these places. And if you need more information, just let us know. We're happy to help.
Travel tip, we are talking about something that we kind of just recently realized that we do. So we love coffee. And before Chris got into his software gig, he worked for a local Michigan coffee chain, which I don't feel like we need to plug, but it created within us a love of coffee and also a dislike of the other big national, international coffee chain that I don't think needs us to say its name, because you know what I'm talking about. So when we travel, we like to look for small independent coffee shops. And we recently discovered that by doing this, we find some really cool places.
Yeah, it's really funny because on its surface, maybe this seems like an obvious tip, like check out local coffee shops. But we had a quick trip to Wisconsin last fall, and we were staying at this hotel in Milwaukee, which we could tell you about another time. It was really, really cool. But we were just looking for coffee nearby. So we look, you know, on the maps, and we found one that was not far. So we walked down there, order our coffee, sit down, start to look around, and we realize, wow, this is really incredible. And we would have completely missed out on the experience had we just gone to the chain that everyone knows. And so I want to talk about that one and the realization, and then I want to just give you some other ones that, you know, looking back, like, these were also really incredible. So the one in Milwaukee was called Fairgrounds Coffee and Tea, and it is sort of fairground themed. So anything from, I mean, they had like signage that was evocative of a fair. There was how would you describe that bench that was like mounted from the ceiling?
It was like a swing,
I guess. Yeah.
Like up against a little bar you could sit on and drink your coffee.
The light fixtures were interesting. And yeah, it was just, you sat there and you realized like, oh wow, someone really was very careful with this place and made a really cool and unique space. And the coffee was really good. That was a place that is the first time that I had at what is, I guess, an espresso old fashioned. It's a non-alcoholic drink. It's not like espresso in alcohol, but it's basically subbing espresso for the alcoholic components of an old fashioned. And it was really good. And, you know, I've never seen that anywhere else. I've made it at home a couple times since then. And so in that moment, we realized, like Ashley said, wow, local coffee shops are places to seek out if you want to have an interesting, unique, and fun experience. So I want to just name a couple more that we feel that way about as well. There's one in Los Angeles in the Grand Central Market called G&B Coffee. The Grand Central Market is a great destination that I'm sure we could have a destination feature on sometimes. It's downtown LA. It's mostly food stalls now, like a lot of markets. But there's G&B Coffee there. I had an espresso tonic, right? Or espresso and tonic. I don't remember how they referred to it, but it's, you know, espresso and tonic water. I wasn't going to get it. I'm like, that sounds weird. Ashley said, that sounds like something you'd like. I'm like, okay, fine. I'll get it. And I liked it.
And you have since made it for everyone that was at our house.
Yeah, we had it at Thanksgiving.
At Thanksgiving.
So that's a really good one. And they may have a couple locations. I'm not sure. Another one close to us is Madcap Coffee in Grand Rapids, just downtown Grand Rapids. Really interesting design of the coffee shop, high quality coffee. One of our absolute favorites, in fact, when we were making this list, we almost forgot it, and then we felt bad, is a place called Mozart's that's in Westlake Hills, which is a neighborhood in Austin, kind of fancy part of Austin, Texas. Tell the people about that one.
Well, I think what I love about Mozart's, I mean, the coffee's fine.
But it's really good.
But you can take your coffee and sit out on a deck overlooking Lake Austin. It's just beautiful. And especially when it's really cold in Michigan and we happen to be in Austin and it's a little bit warmer, it's wonderful.
Yeah, the first time we went to Austin, though, it was really only a little bit warmer.
We still sat outside and enjoyed our coffee.
Yeah, they have lots of food, too, like empanadas and baked goods and things like that, too, right?
Yeah, we had a king cake there.
King cake, yeah, for sure. That's a good one. Another one worth mentioning we just discovered last summer, River Road Coffee and Popsicles in Cocoa, Florida. I feel like Cocoa is a town that people kind of overlook because it's sort of the city that you drive through on the way to the beach, to Cocoa Beach or, you know, anywhere on Merritt Island there. But we found this place while we were getting ready to go on a cruise, and they had all kinds of cool iced coffees and obviously
and popsicles.
Yeah, obviously they have popsicles too. It was a really nice way to spend a little bit of time while we were, you know, sort of in town early and had some time to kill. You know, and there were definitely plenty of chains in that Cocoa area for sure. There are a couple more worth mentioning that are a little bit different than those, but just as we think about some of our favorites, they're worth mentioning. Intelligista in Chicago. They have a lot of Chicago locations. That's kind of a bigger one. It's still local, but it's not sort of in the same way. Still really, really good coffee. Always really fun in there. Always really busy in there. People really like that place. Another really, really special one. I mean, this is as local as it gets, I suppose, is just last December, we went to Café Lareño in Lares, Puerto Rico. And they grow the coffee right there. I mean, you can sit at the bar and watch the coffee beans come in from the field. It is probably the best cup of coffee I've ever had. It's the one I think about every morning that I'm like, as good as this coffee is going to be that I'm about to make, it will be nowhere near as good as Lareño. I think about that pretty much every day.
Yeah, it was amazing, Café Lareño. It was a beautiful location. The coffee was great. The pastries were great.
It's worth mentioning, too, that you can buy their beans both there and in other places on the island. So, like, we've bought Lareño beans before in San Juan. They're really good. It's not as good as when they make it there.
No.
It's just like, I can't replicate that.
Must be the mountain water.
I guess, or the freshness. One more kind of like that we wanted to mention just because it was another experience we had was we were in Spain for a short bit this past summer and in Toledo, Spain, walking back from our Airbnb to the train station, we were on the hunt for more churros and we went to a place called Confitería Toledana. And it was churros and baked goods and coffee and more baked goods. And it was really inexpensive and really, really super delicious.
And they were playing Gangster's Paradise.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, they were playing some interesting music. But we were on, you know, I mean, we were on the lookout and open to these other kinds of coffee shops to have a more local experience. And it's never really steered us wrong.
Right. I cringed a little when we were in Madrid. And I saw somebody step out of the coffee, you know, the international coffee chain that shall not be named, with her cup.
You think they're going to come after us or something?
No, I just feel like they don't need the advertising.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And took her selfie in front of...
Oh, no.
It was a sad moment for me.
That's not a moment you want to preserve, actually. I mean, sometimes you got to do what you got to do in terms of coffee, but not everyone needs to know about it.
That chain is great when you're in the airport.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway.
So if this is not something you've thought about, it's something to think about. That's That's all for today's episode of Go See, Do, Explore. Thank you for joining us and sharing in the wonder of travel.
Keep the spirit of today's adventure alive by checking out our blog at goseedoexplore.com for even more travel inspiration.
Don't forget to rate and review us wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps fellow travelers find us and join our community.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep dreaming, and keep traveling by any means necessary.
I'm Christopher.
And I'm Ashley, bidding you farewell and happy exploring.